Chapter 7 Grievances. At the outset of this chapter, the editor of this work, by the late Alexander Petrovich Goryanchkov, thinks it his duty to communicate what follows to his listeners. In the first chapter of the Recollections of the House of the Dead, something was said about a parricide of noble birth. He was put forward as an instance of the insensibility with which convicts speak of their crimes. It was also stated that he refused altogether to confess to the authorities and the court, but that, thanks to the statements of persons who knew all the details of his case and history, his guilt was proved beyond all doubt. These persons informed the author of the Recollections that the criminal had been of dissolute life and overwhelmed with debts, and that he had murdered his father in order to inherit his property. Besides, the whole town where this parricide was imprisoned told exactly the same story, a fact of which the editor of these Recollections has fully satisfied himself. It was further stated that the murderer, even when in jail, was of quite a joyous and cheerful frame of mind, a sort of inconsiderate, giddy-pated person, although intelligent, and that the author of the Recollections had never observed any particular signs of cruelty about him, to which he added, "So I, for my part, could never bring myself to believe him guilty." Some time ago, the present editor had word from Siberia concerning the discovery that the parricide was in fact innocent, and had done 10 years' hard labour for nothing. That was recognised and avowed by the authorities. The real criminals had been discovered and had confessed, and the unfortunate man in question set at liberty. All this stands upon unimpeachable and authoritative testimony. To say more would be useless. The tragic facts speak too clearly for themselves. Words fail in such cases, when a life has been ruined by an accusation of this kind. Such mistakes as these are among the dreadful possibilities of life, and such possibilities impart a keener and more vivid interest to the Recollections of the House of the Dead, which dreadful place, as we see, may contain innocent as well as guilty men. To continue, I have said that I at last became accustomed, if not reconciled, to the conditions of prison life, but it was a long and dreadful time before I did. It took me almost a year to get used to the prison. I shall always regard those months as the most terrible in my life. They are graven deep in my memory, down to the very smallest details. I think I could recall every single event and the emotions of each successive hour in it. I have said that other prisoners, too, found it equally difficult to get used to the life they were obliged to lead. During the whole of that first year, I used to ask myself whether they were really as calm as they seemed to be. Questions of this kind pressed themselves upon me. As I have already said, every convict felt himself in an alien element to which he could not reconcile himself. The sense of home was an impossibility. He felt as if he were lodging at some vile inn, a mere stage upon a journey. These men, exiles for and from life, seemed to be either in a perpetual smouldering agitation or else in deep depression. But there was not one who had not his own everyday ideas about one thing and another. That restlessness, which, if it did not come to the surface, was still unmistakable, those vague hopes which the poor creatures entertained in spite of themselves, hopes so ill-founded that they were more like the illusions of approaching insanity than anything else, all stamped the place with a character, an originality, peculiarly its own. One could not but feel that there was nothing like it anywhere else in the world. Everybody moved in a sort of waking dream, nor was there anything to relieve or qualify the impression made by the place on each man's personality. All seemed to suffer from a sort of remote hypersensitivity, and this dreaming of impossibilities gave to the majority of the convicts a sombre and morose aspect, for which the word morbid is not strong enough. Nearly all were taciturn and irascible, preferring to keep to themselves the hopes they cherished in secret and in vain. The result was that anything like ingenuousness or truthfulness was the object of general contempt. Precisely because these wild hopes were impossible of fulfilment, and, in spite of everything, well known and confessed to their more lucid selves to be so, they kept them jealously concealed in the most secret recesses of their heart. Yet to renounce them was beyond the power of self-control. It may be they were ashamed of their imagination. God knows, the Russian character is normally so positive and sober in its way of looking at life, so pitiless in criticism of its own weaknesses. Perhaps it was this inward misery of self-dissatisfaction which underlay the impatience and intolerance shown by the convicts towards one another, and the cruel, biting words they spoke to each other. If one of them, more naive or confiding than the rest, put into words what every one of them had in his mind, painted his castles in the air, told his dreams of liberty or plans of escape, they silenced him with brutal promptitude and made the poor fellow's life a burden with their sarcasms and jests. And I think those who did so most unscrupulously had perhaps themselves gone furthest in cherishing futile hopes, indulging senseless aspirations. I have said more than once that those among them who were noticeable for their simplicity and candour tended to be considered stupid and idiotic. They earned nothing but contempt. The convicts were so soured and hypersensitive that they positively hated anything resembling amiability or unselfishness. I should be disposed to classify them all broadly as either good or bad men, morose or cheerful, and to recognize as a class apart those ingenuous fellows who could not hold their tongues. But the sour-tempered were in far the greatest majority. Some of them were talkative, but these were usually of slanderous and envious disposition, always poking their noses into other people's business, though they took good care not to let anyone catch a glimpse of their own secret thoughts. That would have been against the fashion and convention of this strange little world. As to the fellows who were really good, very few indeed were they. They were always very quiet and peaceable, and buried their hopes, if they had any, in strict silence. But those hopes were accompanied by more real faith than was the case with the gloomy-minded. There was, however, yet another category which ought not to be forgotten, the men who had lost all hope, the despairing and the desperate, such, for example, as the old man from Starodoub. But they were very few indeed. That old man from Starodoub. He was extraordinarily subdued and quiet, but there were certain indications of what went on in his mind, indications which he could not hide, and from which I could not but see that his inward life was one of intolerable anguish. Nevertheless, he had one source of help and consolation, prayer, and the belief in his own martyrdom. The convict who was always reading the Bible, of whom I spoke earlier, the one who went mad and attacked the governor with a brickbat, was also probably one of those whom hope had altogether abandoned. And, as it is quite impossible to go on living without hope of some sort, he threw away his life as a sort of voluntary sacrifice. He declared that he attacked the governor, though he had no particular grievance. All he wanted was to suffer torment. Now, what sort of psychological process had been going on in that man's soul? No man lives or can live without having some object in view, and without making efforts to attain that object. But when there is no such object, and hope is entirely fled, anguish often turns man into a monster. The object we all had in view was liberty, the remission of our confinement, and hard labour. I have tried to separate the convicts into sharply defined classes and categories, but it cannot be done satisfactorily. Reality is a thing of infinite diversity, and defies the most ingenious deductions and definitions of abstract thought, nay, abhors the clear and precise classifications in which we so delight. Reality tends to infinite subdivision of things, and truth is a matter of infinite shadings and differentiations. Every one of us in that prison had his own peculiar, interior, strictly personal life, which lay altogether outside the world of regulations and official superintendence. But, as I have said before, I could not penetrate the depths of this interior life in the early part of my prison career, for everything that met my eyes or challenged my attention in any way filled me with a sadness for which there are no words. Sometimes I felt nothing short of hatred for those poor creatures whose martyrdom was at least as great as mine. In those first days I envied them, because they were among persons of their own sort and understood one another, so I thought. But the truth was that their enforced companionship, their comradeship, where the word of command went with the whip or the rod, was as much an object of aversion to them as it was to me, and every one of them tried to keep himself as much as possible to himself. This envious hatred of them, which came to me in moments of irritation, was at least excusable, for those who tell you so confidently that a cultured man of the upper class does not suffer as a mere peasant does are utterly wrong. That is a thing I have often heard said, and read, too. In the abstract, the notion seems correct, and is founded in generous sentiment, for all convicts are human beings. But in reality it is different. At the heart of the problem lie a number of practical complications upon which experience alone can pronounce, experience which I have had. I do not mean to lay it down peremptorily that the nobleman and the man of culture feel more acutely, sensitively, deeply, because of their more highly developed conditions of being. On the other hand, it is impossible to reduce all souls alike to one common level or standard. Neither the grade of education nor anything else furnishes a standard according to which punishment can be meted out. It is a great satisfaction to me to be able to say that among those men who suffered so terribly under a vile and barbarous system, I found abundant proof that the elements of moral development were not wanting. In our prison there were men with whom I was familiar for several years, upon whom I looked as wild beasts and abhorred as such. Well, all of a sudden, when I least expected it, those very men would manifest such a wealth of fine feeling, so keen a comprehension of the sufferings of others, seen in the light of the consciousness of their own, that one could almost fancy that scales had fallen from one's eyes. It was so sudden as to be astonishing. One could scarcely believe one's eyes or ears. Sometimes, however, it was just the other way about. Well-bred and educated men would occasionally display a savage, cynical brutality which nearly turned one's stomach. Their conduct was such that it could be neither excused nor justified, however charitably one might feel disposed. I lay no stress on the fundamental change in habits of life, the food, etc., in respect of which a gentleman suffers so much more keenly than the peasant or working man, who often goes hungry when free, but whose belly is always filled in prison. I will not emphasize that, for it must be admitted that for a man with any strength of character, these external things are trifling when compared with privations of a very different kind. Nonetheless, such total change of material conditions and habits is neither inconsiderable nor easy to endure. On the other hand, the status of a convict involves considerations before which all other horrors pale, even the ubiquitous mud and filth, the scantiness and uncleanness of the food, the irons, and the suffocating sense of always being gripped as in a vice. The capital, the most important point of all, is that after a couple of hours or so, every newcomer from the lower classes shakes down into equality with the rest. He is at home among them. He has the freedom of this city of slaves, this criminal community in which one man is superficially like every other man. He understands and is understood. He is looked upon by everybody as one of themselves. Now it is quite otherwise with a gentleman. However kindly, fair-minded, and intelligent such a man may be, he will be hated and despised by all for years. He will never be trusted or understood. He will be considered neither as friend nor comrade. If he can persuade the others to stop insulting him, it will be as much as he can do, for he will be alien to them from first to last. He is doomed to experience the grief of unending, hopeless, causeless solitude and sequestration. It may sometimes be that this state of affairs is not due to any malice on the part of his fellow prisoners. It simply cannot be helped. The gentleman is not one of the gang, and therein lies the whole secret. There is nothing more terrible than to have to live outside the social sphere to which you properly belong. The peasant, transported from Taganrog to Petropavlovsk, finds there other Russian peasants like himself. Between him and them there can be mutual understanding. Within the hour they will be friends and live comfortably together in the same izba or the same barrack. With the gentleman it is wholly otherwise. A great gulf separates him from the lower classes. How deep and impassable that gulf is appears only when he forfeits his position and becomes as one of the common herd. You may perhaps spend your whole life in daily contact with the peasant. During 40 years, your official position or other duties may lead you to do business with him as regularly as day follows night. You may be his benefactor, all but a father to him, but you will never know what lies at the bottom of the man's mind or heart. You may think you know something about him, but it is all illusion, nothing more. My listeners will no doubt charge me with exaggeration, but I am convinced that I speak the literal truth. I do not found my judgment upon theory or book-reading. The realities of life have given me only too ample time and opportunity to review and correct my ideas, which in this matter have become unshakable convictions. Perhaps my fellow men will some day learn how well-founded are my assertions. At the beginning of my imprisonment, these truths still required demonstration, but events and close observation quickly confirmed my views, and what I experienced so affected me as to undermine my health. During the first summer I wandered about the place, so far as I was free to move, a solitary, friendless man. My moral situation was such that I could not distinguish those convicts who, in the sequel, managed to care for me a little, in spite of the gulf that always remained between us. There were there men of my own position, ex-noblemen like myself, but I found their companionship repugnant. Here is one incident which forced me to realize from the outset how solitary a creature I was, and all the strangeness of my position. On a fine, warm August day, at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a time when, as a rule, everyone took a nap before resuming work, the convicts rose as one man and assembled in the courtyard. I had not the slightest idea until then that anything unusual was afoot. So deeply had I been sunk in my own thoughts that I had scarcely noticed what was going on around me. It seems, however, that the convicts had been smouldering with unwanted discontent for 3 days. It may have started even earlier. So, at any rate, I thought later, when I recalled stray remarks, snatches of conversation that had reached my ears, the palpable increase of ill-humour among the prisoners, and their usual irritability for some time past. I had attributed it all to the trying summer work, the insufferably long days, to their dreaming about the woods and freedom, which the season revived, to the nights too short for rest. It may be that all these things combined to generate a ferment of discontent that only needed a tolerably good reason to explode. That reason was found in the food. For several days, a good deal of plain speaking in barracks had revealed their dissatisfaction, to which they gave voice when assembled for dinner or supper. One of the cooks had been changed, but after a couple of days the newcomer was sacked and his predecessor brought back. The restlessness and ill-humour were general. Mischief was brewing. "Here are we, slaving to death, and they give us nothing but filth to eat," grumbled one in the kitchen. "If you don't like it, why don't you order jellies and blancmange?" said another. "Sour cabbage soup. Why, that's good. I love it. There's nothing more juicy," exclaimed a third. "Well, if they gave you nothing but beef, beef, beef forever and ever, would you like that?" "Yes, they ought to give us meat," said a fourth. "One's almost killed at the workshops. And by heaven, when you're through with the work there, you're hungry. Hungry, and you don't get anything to satisfy your hunger." "It's true. The food's simply damnable. He fills his pockets, don't you fear." "It's none of your business. Whose business is it, then? My belly's my own. If we were all to make a row about it together, you'd soon see." "Yes. Haven't we been beaten enough for complaining, you fool?" "True enough. What's done in a hurry is never well done. And how would you set about making a fuss? Tell me that." "I'll tell you, by God. If everybody will go, I'll go too. I'm just dying of hunger. It's all very well for those who eat apart at a better table to keep quiet, but those who eat the regulation food. There's a fellow with eyes that can do their job. Bursting with envy he is. Don't his eyes glisten when he sees something that doesn't belong to him? Well, pals, why don't we make up our minds? Have we gone through enough? They flay us, the rogues. Let's have a go at them." "What's the good? I tell you, you must chew what they give you and stuff your mouth full of it. Look at the fellow. He wants people to chew his food for him. We're in prison and have got to put up with it." "Yes, that's it. We're in prison." "That's it always. The people die of hunger and the government fills its belly." "That's true. Old Eight Eyes has got nice and fat on it, and he's bought a pair of grey horses." "He doesn't like his glass at all, that fellow," said a convict ironically. "He had a bout at cards a little while ago with the vet. For 2 hours he played without a halfpenny in his pocket. Fedka told me so. That's why we get cabbage soup that's fit for nothing." "You're all idiots. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters." "I tell you, if we all join in complaining, we shall see what he has to say for himself. Let's make up our minds." "Speak for yourself. He'll get his fist on your pate, that's all." "I tell you, they'll have him up and try him." All the prisoners were in a state of acute agitation. The truth is, the food was execrable. The general anguish, suffering, and suspense seemed to be coming to a head. Convicts are naturally quarrelsome and rebellious, but a general revolt is rare, for they can never agree among themselves. We all of us felt that, because there was, as a rule, more violent talk than action. This time, however, the agitation did not die down. The men gathered in groups in their barracks, talking things over excitedly, reciting in detail the governor's misdeeds and trying to get to the bottom of them. In every affair of this kind, there are ringleaders and firebrands. The ringleaders are generally rather remarkable fellows, not only in convict establishments, but among all large organizations of workmen, military detachments, etc. They are always people of a particular type, enthusiastic men with a thirst for justice, very naive, simple, strong, and convinced that their ambitions can be fully realized. They have as much sense as other people, but some, though of high intelligence, are too full of warmth and zeal to exercise self-control. When you come across men who really know how to lead the masses and get what they want, you are face to face with a very different type, one that is extremely uncommon in Russia. The more usual type of leader, the one I first alluded to, does certainly in one sense fulfil his purpose, so far as instigating rebellion is concerned. But in the end, he succeeds only in filling the prisons. Because of his impetuosity, he always comes off second best. But it is this very impetuosity that gives him influence over the masses, whose ardent, honest indignation does its work and encourages the less resolute. His blind confidence of success seduces even the most hardened sceptics. Although this confidence is generally based on such uncertain, childish reasons that it is wonderful how people can put faith in them. The secret of such a man's influence is that he takes the lead and forges ahead without flinching. He rushes forward, head down, and often without any real understanding of what he is about. He has nothing about him of practical outlook, in virtue of which a vile and worthless man often achieves his end and emerges white from a tub of ink. He inevitably dashes his skull against a stone wall. Under ordinary circumstances, these fellows are bilious, irascible, intolerant, contemptuous, and often passionate, which, after all, is part of the secret of their strength. The deplorable thing is that they never aim at what is the essential, the vital part of their task. They invariably concern themselves from the outset with details instead of with essentials, and that is their ruin. But they and the mob understand one another, which makes them formidable. I must say a few words about this particular grievance. Some of the convicts had been transported as the result of a grievance, and these were the most articulate, especially one Martinov, who had formerly served in the Hussars, an eager, restless, and choleric, but worthy and truthful fellow. Another, Vasily Antonov, could work himself up into a rage coolly and collectedly. He generally wore an impudent expression and smiled sarcastically, but he too was honest, a man of his word, and of no mean education. I will not describe them all, they were numerous. Petrov hurried from one group to another. He spoke few words, but he was quite as excited as anyone else, for he was the first to run out of the barrack when the others assembled in the courtyard. Our sergeant, who was acting sergeant major, was quickly on the scene and quite alarmed. The convicts fell into ranks and politely asked him to inform the governor that they wished to speak with him and ask him a few questions. Behind the sergeant stood all the invalids, in rank and facing the convicts. The sergeant, on hearing their request, was frightened almost out of his wits, but he dared not refuse to go and report to the governor, for if the convicts mutinied, God only knew what might happen. All our officers had proved themselves completely incompetent in handling prisoners. Besides, even if nothing worse happened, if the convicts thought better of it and dispersed, the sergeant remained in duty bound to inform the authorities of the occurrence. Pale and trembling with fright, he hurried off to the governor, without attempting to reason with the convicts. He realized, no doubt, that they were not inclined to listen. Without having the least idea of what was going on, I joined the ranks. It was only later that I heard the earlier details of the story. I thought there was going to be a roll call, but could not see the soldiers who checked the lists. Surprised, I began to look about me. The men's faces were working with emotion, and some were ghostly pale. They were sternly silent, and seemed to be thinking of what they should say to the governor. I observed that many of them seemed to wonder at my presence among them, but they looked away from me. No doubt they thought it strange that I should come and take part in their demonstrations, and could scarcely believe their eyes. But they turned again to look at me with curiosity. "What are you doing here?" said Vasily Antonov in a loud, rude voice. He happened to be close to me and a little apart from the rest. He had always hitherto been scrupulously polite. I looked at him perplexed and trying to understand what he meant. I began to see that something unusual was afoot in the prison.
"Yes, indeed. What are you about here? Get back to barracks," said a young soldier convict whom I had never met till then, a good, quiet lad. "This has nothing to do with you," he added.
"Haven't we fallen in?" I answered. "Isn't there going to be a roll call?"
"Why, he's here too," cried one of them. "Iron nose," said another.
This is an insulting phrase which is untranslatable.
"Fly killer," added a third,
with inexpressible contempt for me in his voice. This new nickname caused a general burst of laughter.
"These fellows are in clover everywhere. We're in prison doing hard labour, I rather fancy. They get wheat bread and sucking pig like the great lords they are. Don't you get private supplies of food? What are you doing here?
You've no business here, said Kulikov brusquely, taking me by the hand and leading me out of the ranks. He was himself very pale. His dark eyes sparkled with fire, and he had bitten his underlip until the blood came. He was not one of those who awaited the governor's arrival without losing his self-possession. I liked to look at Kulikov battling in circumstances like these. He appeared in his true colours, in all his strength and weakness. He struck an attitude, but he did not know how to act. I think he would have gone to his death with a certain affected elegance. While everybody else was insulting me by their words or tone of voice, his politeness was greater than ever, but he spoke in firm and resolute accents, which admitted of no reply.
"We are here on business of our own, Alexander Petrovich, and you've got to keep out of it. Go where you like and wait till it's over. Here, your people are in the kitchens. Go there. They're in hot quarters down there."
I did, in fact, see the Poles at the open window of the kitchen, in company with a good many other convicts. I hardly knew what to do, but went there, followed by laughter, abuse, and those muffled growls that are the prison substitute for the hissings and catcalls of the world outside.
"He doesn't like it at all! Chu-chu-chu! Seize him!"
I had never been so bitterly insulted since my arrival. It was a very painful situation, but no more than was to be expected in the abnormal excitement under which the men were labouring. In the anteroom I met Tivsky, a young nobleman of not much information, but of firm, generous character. The others accepted him from the hatred they entertained for convicts of noble birth. They were almost fond of him. His every gesture denoted a brave and upright man.
"What are you doing, Goryanchikov?" he called out. "Come here, come here."
"But what's it all about?"
"They're going to make a formal complaint, haven't you heard?
It won't do them a bit of good. Who'll pay any attention to convicts? They'll try to find out the ringleaders, and if we're among them, they'll blame it all on us. Just remember what we've been transported for. They'll only get a whipping, but we shall be put on trial. The governor detests us all, and would be only too happy to ruin us. All their sins will fall on our shoulders."
"The convicts would bind us hand and foot and sell us outright," added Emtsky when we reached the kitchen.
"They'd never have mercy on us," added Tivsky.
Besides the noblemen, there were in the kitchen about 30 other prisoners who did not wish to join in the general complaint, some because they were afraid, others because of their conviction that the whole proceeding would prove quite useless. Akim Akimich, who was a decided opponent of everything that savoured of complaint, or that could interfere with discipline and the usual routine, waited with keen interest to see the end of the business, about which he did not care a jot. He was perfectly convinced that the authorities would suppress it on the spot. Isaiah Formich's nose drooped visibly as he listened with a sort of fearful curiosity to our conversation. He was much disturbed. With the Polish nobles were some inferior persons of the same nation, as well as some Russians, timid, dull, silent fellows, who had not dared to join the rest, and who waited with melancholy looks to see what the issue would be. There were also some morose, discontented convicts who remained in the kitchen, not because they were afraid, but because they believed this half-revolt an absurdity which could not succeed. It seemed to me that these fellows were considerably disturbed, and their faces were quite unsteady. They saw clearly that they were in the right, and that the issue of the movement would be what they had foretold. But they had a sort of feeling that they were traitors, who had sold their comrades to the governor. Zhulkin, the long-headed Siberian peasant, who had been sent to hard labour for coining, the man who obtained for himself Kulikov's veterinary practice, was also there, as well as the old man from Starodoub. None of the cooks had left their post, perhaps because they looked upon themselves as being more closely related to the authorities of the place, whom it would therefore be unbecoming to oppose.
"For all that," said I to Emtsky, "with the exception of these fellows, everyone's involved."
and no doubt I spoke in a way which betrayed my misgivings.
"I wonder what in the world we would have to do with it," growled B. "We should have risked a good deal more than they if we'd joined them, shouldn't we? Je hais ces brigands. Why, do you think they'll manage to pull it off? I can't see what they want, putting their heads in the lion's mouth. The fools!"
"It'll all come to nothing," said someone, an obstinate, sour-tempered old fellow, with which Almazov, who was also with us, heartily agreed. "Some 50 of them will get a good beating, and that's all the good they'll get out of it."
"Here's the governor!"
cried someone, and everybody ran to the windows. The governor had arrived, spectacles and all, looking evil as might be, towering with rage and red as a turkey cock. He strode in silence right up to the line. In crises like these he showed uncommon pluck and presence of mind, but it ought not to be overlooked that he was nearly always half seas over. Just then his greasy cap with its yellow border and his tarnished silver epaulets gave him a Mephistophelian appearance in my excited fancy. Behind him came the quartermaster, Dyatlov, who was quite a personage in the establishment, for he was really at the back of all official proceedings. He was an extremely capable and cunning fellow, and enjoyed great influence with the governor. He was by no means a bad sort, and the convicts were generally well inclined towards him. The sergeant followed with 3 or 4 soldiers, no more. He had already been severely reprimanded, and there was plenty more of the same to come, if he had only known it. The convicts, who had remained uncovered, caps in hand, from the moment they sent for the governor, stiffened to attention, every man shifting his weight to the other leg. They remained there motionless, and awaited his first word, or rather, his first shout. They had not long to wait. Before he had uttered a single coherent word, the governor began yelling at the top of his voice. He was beside himself with rage. We saw him from the windows, storming down their line, every now and again shooting an angry question. As we were a fair distance off, we could not hear what he said or their replies. We only heard his shouts, or rather, what seemed like shouting, groaning, and grunting, all beautifully blended.
"Scoundrels! Mutineers! To the cat with you! Whips and sticks! The ringleaders! You're a ringleader!"
throwing himself at one of them. We did not hear the answer, but a minute later we saw this convict leave the ranks and make for the guardhouse. Another followed, then a third.
"I'll have you up, every man of you! Who's in the kitchen there?"
he bawled as he saw us at the open windows.
"Come here, the lot of you! Drive them out! Every man!"
Dyatlov, the quartermaster, came towards the kitchens. When we told him that we were making no complaint, he returned and reported to the governor at once.
"Ah, those fellows are not in it," said he, lowering his tone a bit, and much pleased. "Never mind. Bring them along here."
We left the kitchen. I could not help feeling humiliated. All of us went along with our heads down.
"Ah, Prokofiev, Zhulkin too, and you, Almazov. Here, come here, the whole crowd of you,"
cried the governor with a gasp, but he was somewhat softened. His tone was almost affable.
"Emsky, you're here too. Take their names. Dyatlov, take down all the names. The grumblers in one list and the contented ones in another, all without exception. You'll give me the list. I'll have you all before the prison commissioners. Scoundrels!"
This word list had its effect.
"We've nothing to complain of,"
cried one of the malcontents in a half-strangled voice.
"Huh? You've nothing to complain of? Who's that? Let all those who have nothing to complain of step out of the ranks."
"All of us! All of us!"
others exclaimed.
"Ah! The food is all right, then. You've been put up to it. Ringleaders, mutineers, eh? So much the worse for them."
"What do you mean by that?"
cried a voice in the crowd.
"Where is the fellow who said that?"
roared the governor, turning quickly in the direction from which the voice had come.
"It was you, Rastorgulev. You. to the guardhouse with you."
Rastorgulov, a young, chubby fellow of tall stature, left the ranks and went with slow steps to the guardhouse. It was not he who had spoken, but as he was called out, he dared not contradict.
"You fellows are too fat. That's what makes you unruly," roared the governor. "You wait, you hulking rascal. In 3 days you'll wait. I'll have it out with you all. Fall out, all those who have no complaint."
"We're not complaining of anything, Your Excellency," said some of the men dejectedly.
The rest preserved an obstinate silence, but the governor wished to hear no more. It was to his own interest to terminate the affair with as little friction as possible.
"Ah, now I see. No one has anything to complain of," said he. "I knew it. I saw it all. It's the ringleaders. There are ringleaders, by God," he went on, addressing Diadov. "We must lay our hands on them, every man of them. And now, it's time to go to your work. Drummer there! Drummer, a roll!"
He told them off himself in small detachments. The convicts dispersed sadly and silently, only too glad to get out of his sight. Immediately after the gangs had left, the governor betook himself to the guardhouse, where he proceeded to deal with the ringleaders. But he did not push matters far. It was easy to see that he wanted to be done with the whole business as soon as possible. One of the accused told us later that he had begged for forgiveness, and that the officer had let him go immediately. There can be no doubt that our governor did not feel firm in the saddle. He had had a fright, I fancy, for a mutiny is always a ticklish thing. And although this complaint about the food did not amount really to a mutiny, it had been reported only to the governor and the commanding officer, yet it was an uncomfortable and dangerous affair. What caused him most anxiety was that the prisoners had been unanimous in their movement, so their discontent had to be pacified somehow at any price. The ringleaders were soon set free. Next day the food was passable. But the improvement did not last long. On the days immediately following, the governor visited the prison more often than usual, and always found some irregularity to be stopped and punished. The sergeant came and went in a puzzled, dazed sort of way, as if he could not get over his stupefaction at what had happened. As to the convicts, it took them a long time to settle down again, but their agitation seemed to wear quite a different character. They were restless and perplexed. Some went about with their heads down without saying a word. Others discussed the event, grumbling and conscious of their helplessness. A good many said biting things about their own proceedings, as though they were thoroughly dissatisfied with themselves.
"I say, pal, take and eat," said one. "Where's the mouse that was so ready to bell the cat? Let's consider ourselves lucky he didn't have us all soundly thrashed. It would be a good deal better if you thought more and chattered less. What do you mean by lecturing me? Are you schoolmaster here, I'd like to know? Oh, clear off. Who are you, I'd like to know? I'm a man. What are you? A man? You're... I say, shut up, do. What's the good of all this row?" was the cry from all sides.
After work on the evening of the day the mutiny took place, I met Petrov behind the barracks. He was looking for me. As he approached, I heard him muttering something which I did not understand. He said no more, but walked by my side in a listless, mechanical fashion.
"I say, Petrov, your fellows are not annoyed with us, are they?"
"Who's annoyed?"
he asked, as if waking from a dream.
"The convicts, with us noblemen." "Why should they be annoyed?"
"Well, because we didn't back them up."
"Oh, why should you have kicked up a dust?" he answered, as if trying to understand my meaning. "You have a table to yourselves, you fellows."
"Oh, well, there are some of you who are not nobles and don't eat the regulation food, and yet they sided with you. We ought to have backed you up. We're all in prison, and we should all be comrades."
"Heavens! You are comrades?" he asked, with unfeigned astonishment.
I looked at him.
It was clear that he had not the least idea of what I meant. I, on the other hand, understood him thoroughly. I now saw quite clearly something of which I had before only a confused idea. What I had previously guessed was now a sad certainty. I was forced to realize that any sort of true fellowship between the convicts and myself could never be. Even if I remained for the rest of my life in the place, I belonged to a kind of special section. I was a creature forever apart. The expression on Petrov's face when he said, "Are we comrades? How can that be?" remains and will always remain before my eyes. It was a look of such frank, naive surprise, such ingenuous astonishment, that I could not help asking myself if there was not some lurking irony in the man, a slight shade of sarcasm. Not at all. He was quite sincere. I was not their comrade, and could never be. That was all. "Go you to the right? We'll go to the left. Your business is yours, ours is ours." After the mutiny, I honestly believed they would show us as little mercy as they dared and could, and that our life would become hell. But nothing of the sort happened. We heard not the slightest reproach. There was not the least criticism of what had occurred. It was simply passed over. They went on teasing us as before whenever they had an opportunity, but no more frequently. No one seemed to bear malice against those who stayed in the kitchen and who had not taken part, or against those who had been the first to back down and proclaim that they had no complaint. To my astonishment, it was all forgotten.